You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If you follow business news, you've probably heard about McKinsey and Company, but you may not have a very good idea of what exactly the management consulting firm does, and McKinsey would probably like to keep it that way. In his new book, Fortune contributing editor Duff McDonald lifts the curtain on McKinsey, explaining how the company became the industry leader, advising everyone from Enron to the White House since its founding in the 1920s. The firm, the story of McKinsey and the secret influence on American business, is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Duff McDonald to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Now, consulting is a notoriously abstract term. What exactly does McKinsey do for its clients?
They do a lot of things, but what they're known most for is what you might call corner office consulting, in which they advise CEOs, boards of directors on the biggest questions that they're facing. You know, what should we do? How do we solve this problem? And they feel a need to bring in an outsider.
But not PR problems. It's not like when Johnson & Johnson had the problem with tainted pharmaceuticals. This is more like, what are we going to do now because our competition from China is hurting us?
Yeah. By strategic consulting in this context, it's much longer range outlook stuff. I don't think they do quick turnaround, like how to respond to this bad piece of PR.
The firm was founded by James McKinsey, who was a University of Chicago accounting professor. How did McKinsey's ideas about consulting emerge from his work as an accountant?
Well, James McKinsey is actually responsible for a real revolution in accounting. Before he came onto the scene, accounting was more backward looking. You know, it was a record of the previous year. How much tax do we owe? What are our expenses? And what he did is he actually flipped it around and used it as a tool for planning and resource allocation for the future. So that was a really revolutionary idea at the time. It seems very obvious to us today, but in the 20s, it was novel and new.
Well, could it have been possible before the mid-20s? The mid-20s are a time of great boom. Of course, it ends rather badly.
Yeah, the origins of the consulting industry itself and some of these ideas that McKinsey had definitely had to do with the seismic changes that were happening, particularly in America at the time, which was the emergence, because of the scale and scope of this country, we had suddenly had these businesses that were so huge, they had no historical precedent, and the managers or the owners of these companies were suddenly grappling with a very fundamental question of how do we control this thing? Our success has been so huge that we're suddenly worried that this thing's going to spin out of control.
And then they had to deal with the government. How did the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890, the Clayton Act in 1914, Glass-Steagall Act in 1933 help give rise to the consultant industry?
Well, basically, you know, back in the days of the robber barons and even, you know, guys that are – who've had sort of whitewashed reputations today like J.P. Morgan, you know, this was – that was the era of backroom deals, of price fixing, of complete collusion among giant businesses to set prices. And when the government tried to step in the number of ways you just mentioned, companies were suddenly faced with the possibility that these discussions they were having were coming to an end. And consulting sort of arose as a legal way to keep that conversation going. If everyone else talks to the consultants, then, you know, you all can sort of keep up to date on what everyone else is doing.
Did the Great Depression have any impact on the consulting business?
Remarkably, it was, you know, like any huge secular economic shift, I'm sure some of their business fell off on the margin there, but it did give rise to an emerging part of their business, which was rationalization, cost cutting, and basically the first big sort of mass layoffs that happened, and consultants were brought in to help companies figure out how to do that.
They did that in 1935. They were hired by Marshall Field to help reduce its debt, and McKinsey suggested closing their wholesale business, which meant over 1,000 layoffs. And he received death threats, didn't he?
He did, and one of the real ironies I came across in writing this book was the board of directors of Marshall Field actually hired James McKinsey. They asked him to come over to be CEO. They loved the consulting firm's advice so much. They said, "Hey, why don't you come actually implement this stuff?" And he received death threats. He actually found the experience enormously stressful and contracted pneumonia and what actually died shortly thereafter. And one of the things he said in the year or so before his death was, "I never realized how much harder it was to actually do things than to merely tell people what to do," which is the biggest attack on consulting we always hear.
But weren't they also taking the heat off of the people at Marshall Field by making these suggestions? Marshall Field could say, "Well, we just called in a consulting firm, and they said that that's the best strategy."
Absolutely. And the big selling points of McKinsey and other consultants these days is that they are willing to take the heat. There's sort of a mercenary force that will come in and say, for the right amount of fees here, you can tell your employees or your board, McKinsey told me to do this, and definitely you can pass the buck internally as a CEO and try and push responsibility to an outsider.
Why did James McKinsey think that it was more useful to look at why a company was doing something rather than how it was doing it?
Well, that's sort of the origins of again, strategic consulting itself. Once business gained a certain level of respectability, particularly in this country, which is, based on a kind of entrepreneurialism, we went through a series of evolutions, which were first, companies just did what they did, sold what they sold. And at some point, people started thinking about companies, planning ahead, strategizing, and sort of bringing deeper ways of thinking into managing a business. And that gave rise to consultants who said, "You know what? We'll do this all the time. When you have a need for this kind of thinking, why don't you bring us in and we'll let you know the current thinking."
My guest is Jeff McDonald, whose latest book is The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. So McKinsey, as you said, died very young, the age of 48, and Marvin Bower took over?
There was another managing director in between. The Marvin Bower was the third managing director of McKinsey, but in its history is the spiritual godfather. He ran the place for a couple decades.
And created the McKinsey culture that we see today?
Absolutely.
What did it include?
One thing that I found entirely fascinating is that this company was not built by accident. It was by design. Bower was relentless and focused about everything from the way that the consultants would comport themselves, the way they dressed, the way they spoke, the language that they used, to the way that they should ingratiate themselves in their local community.
The list includes put the firm's interest ahead of self-interest, the client's interest ahead of the firm's interest. And reading that reminded me of the ethos that William Cohen described at Goldman Sachs in his book, Money and Power. You call McKinsey the Goldman Sachs of consulting.
Yeah, it's a little different than Goldman. What Bower was trying to do there was to actually create a new profession, like a law or medicine, where you take on from the outset a different set of responsibilities than sheer commerce, which Goldman is in commerce at the end of the day.
And Bower even came up with a lexicon that we still hear today: clients instead of customers, role instead of job, values instead of rules.
Yeah, and from a cynical perspective on the outside, it's just wordplay, right?
Department of Defense instead of Department of War.
Yeah, exactly. And I go at various instances of the book, I say, you can call yourselves whatever you want, but at the end of the day, you're still a profit seeking company doing business. So, but again, one of the brilliant things about the McKinsey's history is that they set themselves apart by a deliberate adherence to this kind of stuff, including the language. And here we are almost a century later, and they still do have this distance between them and the competition that's unrivaled in any other professional services realm.
The other people in the business, because there are other consultant firms, Booz Allen Hamilton, Mitt Romney's former firm, Bain and Company, Boston Consulting Group, they're all much smaller?
They are well, there's actually two kinds of consultants. There's the big systems integrators like Deloitte and Ernst & Young and Accenture. They're massive. They're $20, $30 billion in revenues. McKinsey's relatively smaller at $7 or $8 billion in revenues. But in that sort of niche of strategic consulting, they're the giant versus the Booz and the Bains and the BCGs.
Now, was Bauer the person who created the up-and-out culture at the firm?
He brought it into the firm. Upper out is generally credited to Cravath Swain, the law firm. And it's sort of an HR philosophy, which is if you're not moving forward or upward and with a sort of relentless review cycle, maybe you should be thinking of doing something else.
So the average age of a McKinsey consultant is 32.
And it hasn't changed for decades.
And Bauer was a lawyer, wasn't he, rather than an economist or an accountant or the kind of person we might assume would be the head of a company like this?
Yeah, he'd worked at Jones Day at the time, which is a prominent national law firm. And he's quoted as saying, he loved the strategizing part of being a corporate lawyer, but he hated all the legal stuff. And what he set out to create with McKinsey was essentially a law firm that didn't practice law.
So how do you climb the corporate ladder there? How do you survive the firing before you're 32?
Well, you've got to be, just like it's sort of philosophical relative on Wall Street, you got to be prepared to work the long hours. They bring in young people and drive them hard. You've got to be creative. You got to be thoughtful. And the unique thing about consulting is that they need to have ideas, but also with a pragmatic end to them.
Well, we're talking about consulting with businesses, but didn't the Eisenhower White House hire the firm in 1953?
Yeah, they did. They brought in it all goes back to the sort of efficiency thing. And what Eisenhower was looking to do was both to sort of reorganize the White House, but also find the most efficient way to what he called exercise the will of the people, which was essentially what appointments do I need to make that will allow me the maximum degree of control over this government that I want. And McKinsey was a very obvious candidate to help him do that, because that's kind of the thing that they do with companies.
Except that I would have thought that experienced politicians might have been able to give him that kind of advice.
That's true. And the beauty or the criticism, but also the beauty of these guys is that the criticism is they send in a bunch of young MBAs to tell experienced executives how to better do something they've never even done before. On the other hand, a fresh eye never hurt anybody. And the fact that that McKinsey in particular is working with so many other people gives them a sort of best practices view of particularly organizational consulting stuff that no one else has.
Hasn't McKinsey been hired by governments around the world ever since?
They are everywhere. They're in the Obama administration. They're particularly influential in England. But in the book, I even talk about them being such a big expense to the government of Tanzania at one point that they were a line item in the country's budget.
Duff McDonald's book, The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business, is published by Simon & Schuster. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Duff McDonald, who's a contributing editor at Fortune magazine and the New York Observer, and a regular contributor to Vanity Fair, New York, and other publications. His latest book, The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business, is published by Simon & Schuster. And what about that word secret? I mentioned earlier that McKinsey would like us to not know what they do. How did they is there some kind of secret language that they use with businesses so that they understand while the rest of us are excluded?
You know, one of the fascinating things in reporting about these guys is, as a journalist, you generally find it hard to get people to say negative things about the people you're writing about for any number of reasons.
Well, they have to do business with them.
Exactly. But the thing with McKinsey, and that's really funny, is it's even harder to get satisfied customers to say positive things about them, because the deal with a consultant is you hire them, and if their advice or their ideas work out for you, as the CEO, you don't want to say, well, hey, you know, don't thank me. Thank these outside guys here who told me what to do. So, and they're totally happy with not taking credit publicly. So it's remarkable, like, the secrets, both the negative stuff and the positive stuff. Nobody talks about them in either circumstance.
Are consultants as heavily regulated as companies that hire them?
Absolutely not. And in part, and in their defense, it's that they're only advisors. You know, they may be at the scene of many financial disasters, but they're not the ones making decisions.
Well, if you are an ad agency or many other kind of firm, you can't work for more than one company in a given industry. In fact, often you're specifically prohibited from doing so because of the potential conflict of interest. That's not the case with McKinsey.
No. And in fact, a couple of big clients like Philip Morris and Exxon tried to force them to be their sole client in that particular industry over the years. And McKinsey balked. Companies actually use them for the very reason that they're actually talking to everybody else. Another author made a point, which I quoted in the book, which is, when you hire these guys, you know there's information going out and information coming in. You're just making the bet that the value coming in is higher than that going out.
But they don't reveal their list of clients.
They never reveal their list of clients.
We only find out after the fact.
Yeah, you know, some things rise to the level of media events, like the fall of Enron, or some CEOs will break the compact and mention McKinsey, try and pin the blame on them.
Or the other way around, General Electric.
General Electric was a big user of McKinsey. Jack Welch, was everything about his career was because of some work that McKinsey did that restructured McKinsey to be better, or GE to be better able to execute. But again, you didn't find him saying, oh, McKinsey told me to do all this.
Well, McKinsey has recommended layoffs for decades. Do they operate as a kind of a firewall for the CEOs of these companies? Does it provide cover or confirmation of what the CEO wanted to do all along?
Absolutely. I think there's 10 reasons to hire McKinsey. One of them is, again, to do that, to have someone else to blame. Another one is to get a decision by your board that you've already made. Another one is just to find out what other people in the industry are doing.
But then you can only cut the workforce so much. Sometimes companies will probably follow that advice and then discover they can't get the product out.
Yeah. For better or for worse, the McKinsey stands for efficiency and rationality and operating more effectively. And in times of, business trouble, layoffs are one of the answers to the questions of how can we operate more profitably.
The firm did stumble when it was hired by General Motors in the 1980s. How did they suggest the automaker change to stay competitive with Japanese car makers?
You know, the origins of McKinsey's business were in what's called organizational consulting. You know, it goes back to the point I was making earlier about companies became so big, they said, how do we even organize ourselves? And the sort of family tree chart you see of org charts in companies, it's called the M-form chart. That was something they helped disseminate in the early days. And they spread it all through the U.S. and all through Europe. And when GM was having trouble, what McKinsey's mistake was, and GM's ultimately, you know, the Japanese threat was about a different way of manufacturing
and also producing a better car.
And also making a better car and having higher quality. And what McKinsey did was sort of went back to its, you know, age old, like, the answer is don't organize around this, call it car brand, organize around that car type. And so what they did was sort of blow up internal lines of communication within General Motors, restructure all these sort of lines of reporting, and create some sort of internal chaos there. But they were aiming at – they weren't even addressing the real issue.
I always wondered why they didn't just – General Motors just didn't take apart a Honda and a Toyota and say, okay, what have they done here? Why can't we just do the same thing? Instead, they came up with the Saturn, although I don't know whether McKinsey had anything to do with that.
Yeah, it's hard – you know, it's hard to say because even even when it rises to the level of McKinsey's name being mentioned in public, these reports are – you know, McKinsey reports are fairly hard to come by. So their specific advice, it's very rare that you can come across it.
Did they get criticism for what happened at GM?
They did. And their response was the same as it always is when a client gets in trouble, which is they implemented our advice incorrectly. And, you know, we can only do so much for these guys. They've got to do the end themselves.
My guest is Duff McDonald. His latest book, The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The publisher, by the way, is Simon & Schuster. The firm had a very long working relationship with American Express, and at one point, McKinsey employees were listed in the American Express office phone book. Did that relationship devolve into codependency?
That's a great word to use. One of the things that these consultants are criticized for, but it's a brilliant business strategy, is preying on the insecurities of a fearful chief executive. And, you know, you're always concerned if it's lonely at the top, right? And you're always concerned that your lieutenants may also be looking to stab you in the back. And so one of the reasons that so many CEOs hire companies like McKinsey is for a disinterested opinion from someone who isn't gunning for your job. And in fact, one of the brilliant things McKinsey does is they have personal relationships rather than corporate ones.
But there also seems to have been a certain amount of arrogance that has crept in along with the firm's success. You've been suggesting that. Was that because Rajat Gupta replaced Marvin Bauer in 1994? Or had that been
coming along earlier? No, these guys have been arrogant since the get-go. You know, it's a really smart group of people. I say in the book that they, more than one of them has referred to themselves as the greatest collection of talent the world has ever seen. And, it might actually be true if you did sort of an average IQ or something. But I go on to say they're claiming to have won a game that no one else is playing.
Well, you're right that the company has more contradictions than the Bible. Its methods have been compared to the Jesuits and the U.S. Marines.
By themselves, in fact. You will not find a more self-confident group of people.
What happens when they have when they get some bad press?
Well, you brought up Rajat Gupta. You know, the remarkable thing about him, which was he ran McKinsey for 9 years. He was convicted in this Rajaratnam insider trading trial from selling boardroom information out of Goldman Sachs to Rajaratnam. That didn't really hurt McKinsey's billings at all, amazingly, but it hurt their self-image.
What about the Enron scandal? It was hired by Enron, and CEO Jeffrey Skilling actually was a former McKinsey employee.
Enron is, in my opinion, McKinsey's biggest mistake. As you say, Skilling was ex-McKinsey. And McKinsey celebrated Enron right up until the very end. And a lot of the ideas, he used up or out there. He called it rank and yank. But it was what Enron became was sort of the ugly culmination of sort of many McKinsey ideals taken to their extreme, where vision mattered more than execution, or aggressive employees could outpace and displace more boring but actually effective employees, and it ultimately became disconnected from reality in the end.
When Enron collapsed, how much fallout was there from McKinsey?
Amazingly, again, not much. Arthur Andersen is gone. McKinsey was pulling in $10 million plus a year from these guys in advisory fees. They weren't sued by any creditors. They weren't called to Congress. Nothing at all. Remarkable. Again, they've built this beautiful business model where they take no credit, take no blame. It's power without responsibility.
And then we mentioned the situation with Rajat Gupta, who was convicted in 2012 of conspiracy and securities fraud. He was the managing director of McKinsey from 1994 to 2003, and he became a senior partner. Anil Kumar was a senior partner of McKinsey as well, the man who pleaded guilty. How did the firm respond when the Securities and Exchange Commission filed the first charges in March 2011?
Well, they immediately set about doing their own internal investigation, because the big risk there is whether it's sort of a systematic thing internally or whether you just had a couple of rogue employees. And, you know, what they said is they found that, no, it was just a couple of rogue employees. And
These are people in the major in top leadership.
Exactly. Well, that's the real shocking thing, is Gupta wasn't there anymore, but he'd run the firm. And Kumar was actually breaking the compact of consulting, which is, you tell us everything about you, we won't tell anybody else. And he was selling client information out the back door. But they did outreach to all their clients. And I even spoke to some of their clients who said, look, when you get this big, it's not a question of whether you're going to have rogue employees. It's a certainty. It's just when and how big. So most of their clients weren't really fazed by it.
And most of them give them repeat business.
Yeah. And in fact, those very clients whose information Kumar was selling remain clients of McKinsey.
We, in looking at other businesses, we see businesses doing very well, and then they don't respond to changes in the world. Microsoft didn't really understand what Apple was all about. Apple is now facing problems from Samsung, and I assume somebody else is going to come along and affect their business models as well. How has that worked in this area?
You know, I make the point in this book, they have an amazing capacity to evolve. It has a lot to do with their culture, but it also has a lot to do with what they do. Because they don't actually have a physical product, they sell advice. They basically help people deal with whatever the big problem is they're facing today. So I make the point that they sell what their clients are buying. And so talk about a business that is capable of evolving. People are always buying something. They always have a question they need help with. And if you've managed to position yourself, as McKinsey has, as the people who can help you answer the tough questions, you've got a perpetual possible business on your hands.
If I learn that management here at WNYC is called in McKinsey, should I assume that I'm on my way out, or some of my coworkers are?
I don't know whether you can assume it, but it would be a reasonable thing to expect. They are well known for being brought in as hatchet men for layoffs. They don't like that, obviously, that reputation. But again, you know, if you're being hired to help a business figure out how to do what it does a little better or more profitably, one of the outcomes can be layoffs.
McKinsey established its first overseas office in London in the 1950s. That's quite a while back. Has it turned its attention abroad in recent years as business has become increasingly global and China's economy has expanded?
Absolutely. They've almost succeeded as much as they could in some of the more Western countries like the U.S., England, and Germany. And their fastest growing part of their business is in Asia. Their current managing director, Dominic Barton, spent the bulk of his career in Asia before taking the helm of the firm. So absolutely, the firm is has making a big push in the East.
Duff McDonald's latest book is called The Firm, The Story of McKinsey and Its Secret Influence on American Business. So the next time I go to the CBS and they say next client instead of next customer, I should assume that that is because of the influence of someone like McKinsey?
You can thank McKinsey for that. You can thank him for a whole lot of other things. You know, they legitimized the MBA, the whole MBA industrial complex. It's either their fault or to their credit, depending on your point of view.
Well, thank you, McKinsey. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you, Duff McDonald, for being on our show.
Thanks very much for having me.